Welcome everybody to this first session. In this session, we are going to see first unit. I don't know if you had time or to read this chapter. This session is meant for you to ask any doubts that you may have. So you can also download the presentation. As you have seen in the course, I have included already the recordings of last year in case you want to advance quicker than the schedule that we have here for the presentations for this year. They will slightly change in any case, but they are basically the same, although as I said, the PowerPoints have changed a bit. I have made slight changes, but they are enough for you to follow the course independently of these sessions. And so you can already, what I will do is to start substituting one by another. So now that we have seen this unit here, I will include this session in the course, and I will change it by the one that we have from last year. Okay. So I don't know if you read the first chapter, I hope. Otherwise, it's fine because we are going to see it now. Let me see how, cambiar page. Okay. So in this session, as you know, we are going to see briefly chapter one, and especially I want you to ask any doubts that you may have or to share any doubts, okay? You can also share these doubts on the forum, of course. So the first chapter is very important because it's a theoretical introduction to the contents of the course. And with this, without this theoretical, it is very difficult to follow the rest of the course. So it is basically that. So in this unit, as you know, we deal with the construction of dictionaries, the construction of ontologies, and terminological applications. So we are going to see here briefly the difference between dictionaries, between ontologies, and between terminologies and terminological databases, and also the theoretical framework or concepts the theoretical foundations for this type of semantic applications. Okay, so let's start first by lexicography. Here you have the links to all these. As you have seen, I introduce material apart from the course book, of course. And one of the interesting material comes from this Encyclopedia for the Social and Behavioral Sciences. And there we have a very interesting definition of lexicography. Basically, lexicography is the craft of dictionary compilation. So it is as simple as this. Lexicography is based is the art and craft of dictionary compilation, and that's the reason why it is the oldest subdiscipline of linguistics, because it didn't even start as a theory. As you know, linguistics started being considered a science already at the end of the 19th century or beginning of the 20th century with Saussure and the sign and the reference and all these concepts. Before, it was just, for instance, translation with the translation of the Bible was also a craft. Lexicography was a craft, but first comes the craft, and then people start to philosophize or theorize about what they are doing, and then comes the theory. So lexicography is an art or a craft. And this is a very interesting quotation, but read everything now because we don't have time, but we can what it says basically is that there are many types of dictionaries, and these you know, and all dictionaries dictionaries will be of different types depending on the contents they will include, so the properties they will have. They can be dictionaries dealing with spelling, with sound. Some of them are historical dictionaries. Others are etymological. Others include a lot of grammatical features. Others have to do with derivational features, etc. And then we have general dictionaries, which can be bilingual, monolingual, or everything at the same time, etc. But there are two important technological innovations that are crucial for the representation of lexical information. First, the art of printing. As you know, this led to the expansion of the book, and the printing was the biggest change in those times. Now we have the second big landmark of the mankind in the history of knowledge, which is the digital development, so the computer. The computer has been an important landmark in the art of lexicography. As opposed to this, we have lexicology. Lexicology is more the theory, so it's the investigation of the lexicon of the language. So it can analyze historical development, social stratification. It can be a general analysis of language, or it can be focused on specific aspects of language, for instance, morphology, as we will see in Unit 2. So lexicology research is about language. It's more the philosophical side, the theory, let's say. So the biggest landmark has been digital lexicography. And we have here Wolfgang Klein, which in the second edition of the International Encyclopedia of the Social and Behavioral Sciences focuses on five main lines of development of digital lexicography. First of all, that dictionaries are created for various tasks. It is important to notice that they are machine readable. So now we have a printed version of a dictionary, and we also have a machine readable version, so a digital version. This means that we can store much more lexical information than before. We can include formal representation, which is different from natural language, as we will see in this unit and in throughout the course. For instance, WordNet, which was a very important landmark in the creation of lexicological or lexicographical or even conceptual databases, which was developed by Princeton, and then FrameNet, which was developed in Berkeley, where they do paraphrases of words. They create nets of words. These are the first attempts to deal with conceptual databases, to play with concepts. Another important feature of digital lexicography is that there are many databases, and you can include all kinds of lexical properties there. So you can choose what to include. In a dictionary, as we have said, this is also part of the art of craft of lexicography, that you can create an etymological dictionary based on the old English, or you can choose the language. You can make it bilingual. You can make it general. You can make a learner's dictionary. You can compile a dictionary of metaphors. I remember I studied a very interesting dictionary I consulted for a study I did very long time ago, almost 20 years ago, and I analyzed metaphors for a course that I was doing during my PhD. Later on, I was able to publish it, and my supervisor told me that there was a dictionary for idioms, for instance. This is super interesting for me to know that there are people who are compiling idioms. We can, for instance, in my village. My village is Cervera del Río Alhama, which is in the southern part of La Rioja. You see, La Rioja is like a kind of animal, and the lake on the back part, well, this is part of La Rioja Baja, which is on the border with Aragon, Navarra, it is on the border of Navarra and of Aragon at the same time. So we have accent, and especially we have a lot of special words, let's say, a lot of terminology that is very Cerverano. We speak Cerverano, and there is, for instance, a professor in the University of La Rioja who is from Cervera, and he even published a dictionary of words of our village. And the dictionary is a really a full dictionary. So many people don't even understand when we are talking, because we have so many specific words in that village that he could even make a dictionary of Cerverano. And here you have some examples. I have checked the links today, they work. You can have, for instance, Brigham Young University is an example of a database of a lexicographical work for concordances. Co-occurrences is with prepositions, all these chunks, word categories. You can also have other types of dictionaries where that you have, for instance, in the corpus of Leipzig, we have word frequency, we have collocations. So nowadays we can have all kinds of lexicographical compilations. Another important aspect of dictionaries nowadays, of transferring dictionaries to the computer, of digitalizing lexicography, is of course that it is a much faster, not only the compilation, also the retrieval. You have probably experienced the big difference between searching for a word in the RAE, in the Spanish Dictionary of Real Academia Española de la Lengua, or going to the RAE online and just typing the word. For me, it was even strange at the beginning, like, because this is a very intuitive and basic, simple, very user-friendly database of Spanish. So it was, you click on the word, you immediately have it, whereas the dictionary is like this, you have to, of course, alphabetically look for the word, etc. So we have to be careful not to lose this this ability to think alphabetically. So the information is easier to retrieve, but also for lexicographers, it is much easier to revise and update. So a dictionary, when it was published, they had to immediately start working on a new edition. In order to update the dictionary, because as you know, language evolves very fast, especially English, which is especially now with the new technologies, with the social networks, the Instagram, TikTok, everything makes it a super quick evolved language. So the speed to which in which you have to continuously update the dictionary, well, depending on the dictionary, of course, because as you know, we could discuss this in another session, but there are some institutions, such as in our case for Spanish speakers, the Real Academia Española de la Lengua, which is, this has always been a very interesting source of debate. In the Spanish language is not that it doesn't evolve as quickly as other languages. It is that we have an institution that is controlling what is accepted and what is not accepted, and of course it goes quite it is more purista. It is said in Spanish. It is much more. It tends to take longer to accept the new coinages than other languages such as English, because there is not an institution like in Spanish that has a control over what is correctly said and what is not. These institutions always go after the speaker. So when a term is used constantly, at some point they have to end up accepting the term and including it in the dictionary. But it is very interesting, for instance, to see, and if you want to do in the future a TFG, I know this subject nobody chooses it because they think it's very complicated, but I can tell you that there are some topics that we can choose that are not so boring, And two of my students, of my previous students, I suggested this study, which was, one was very interested in fashion terminology. And we did the comparison. She compiled the terms that were used in a specific amount of fashion magazines, not even the social networks. This would have been even more striking. And she compared, she compiled these terms, and then she did an analysis of which of these terms were already accepted in the dictionary, of the RAE dictionary or not. And of course, the results were according to our hypothesis that the RAE has a policy, a non-acceptance policy. So very little words, we have jumper, cardigan, sweater, all these words we mean. She found out we have terms, maybe I don't remember now specifically which ones, all of them, most of them coming from English, but also some of them coming from French or even Italian, and most of them were not still accepted by the RAE. So an interesting study could be to do the same, but with other types of jargon or lexicological terminologies. A terminology, as we will see in this course, is a specific, the language used in a specific field, a language knowledge field. For instance, the terminology for computers, the terminology for all this vocabulary that now the young people use. like te cancelo or things like this. These are quite interesting how they are formed. So a study of this would be also a very interesting study. So it's just a suggestion. Well, basically the characteristic that I want you to memorize is that they are very easy to update, of course, and to revise. You don't have to wait to another edition. And this means cheaper maintenance and also higher quality in this sense. Another interesting feature is that they are computer-based instead of human-based compilation, which means that you can introduce in a computer a corpora This text makes a very interesting comparison. The first Oxford English Dictionary was based on 5 million texts. So in order to compile a dictionary, we need a corpora of texts from which we extract examples of use of these, of certain terms, of certain words. So 5 million excerpts before was considered, well, an amazing amount of texts and of words. They were or handwritten or based on paper slips. And nowadays, corpora can easily process several hundred million words. So several hundred million occurrences. Compare these to before. So the most important thing is that this allows a much broader and a much more representative coverage of a lexicon than ever. Okay. What is the bad? The bad is that electronic corpora only provide raw material. So we still need the person. We still need the human to do this lexical analysis. Okay. So humans, fortunately, are still needed in the arts and crafts of lexicography. It is the same as in translation. Translation nowadays is based on machine translation, but the aspect where we still need the human is in the post-editing process. We still need humans to revise a translation of the output. Okay. And finally, the digital lexical systems. The digital lexical systems are particular of digital dictionaries and integrate sources of information from various sources of information. They introduce computer accessible and expandable corpus, as we have seen. We also have tools for statistical analysis, determination of the first occurrence, to look at the number of occurrences. Everything, all this can be automatic, can be made automatic. But we still need the lexical analysis of the corpus, made by experienced lexicographers. So, for instance, the text gives an example, the addition of spoken forms in various dialects, or information about word classes, the semantic analysis of lexical units, the revision of translation equivalents, etc. And here you have a link where you will later on, if you want, check for an example. Here, we will not get into that now because this type of video conference tool does not allow for that, but I suggest you watch these two presentations, which are very simple to watch, easy to watch, and I have included them also in the course. So the first one establishes this difference, summarizes the difference between lexicology and lexicography, and the second one explains what is lexicology. So you will be, it will be very easy for you to remember after you have. So, focusing now on lexicology. By now we have said we have analyzed what we study in lexicography. In lexicology, we study language. Okay? So, here I give an example of what we study, which is where the book focuses. Lexicology is the study of language, the phenomenon, the linguistic phenomena. You can study, as you will see in the YouTube, a video that I have included in the course and here. Lexicology studies language from different perspectives. It can be historical lexicology, and then we would analyze etymological events. It could be morphological events. We can also study through lexicology, or we can study general lexicology. And among the topics that interest mostly lexicologists, theorists of language, one that is a key category for lexicology, which is gender. Why? Because gender is very interesting to see how different languages categorize genders. And we know, for instance, Spanish has a grammatical gender, as you know, first of all, you know, grammatical gender is not the same as sex. And languages express gender in different ways. In Spanish, for instance, we have a, o. And some genders don't finish in a, o, which are irregular morphological examples of a masculine or feminine. Other languages express, don't have, such as English. English doesn't have grammatical gender. Well, of course it has grammatical gender, but it doesn't show grammatical gender morphology. So there is no morphological distinction for distinguishing masculine or feminine. However, there are languages that distinguish masculine, feminine, and neutral. And there are languages here, for instance, as you see here in this paragraph, that says that there are special, some strange languages where gender is marked depending on who is, depending on the sex of the speaker, we can give a masculine or a feminine gender to a word. So all these interesting features are part of the study of gender through a lexicological point of view. And this has an influence, obviously, on how later on we shape lexical entries in the dictionary. So, because gender, as you know, is one of the important categories that we need to include in the entries of a dictionary. This is also studied in a unit 4, I don't remember of the book, but there is one unit of the book that is specifically devoted to lexicographical compilation and the different categories that are included in a general dictionary. Okay? So, as well as the etymological information, plural or singular information, how a word conforms the plural, another important and very important type of information that we need for a word is to know its gender. And this we need to include in a lexical entry. A lexical entry is one of the entries of a dictionary. So it is a concern for lexicologists, also for psycholinguistics, and in turn for lexicographers. Well, now going, we are going to continue dealing with theoretical concepts, the theoretical concepts that are also introduced in Unit 1. The first one is the idea of conceptualization. So, what do we understand by conceptualization? Conceptualization is how we think of a certain type of information in our minds, how we experience the world. That's why Lakoff, and also previously to Lakoff, which is where the cognitive linguistics comes from, we have this sentence that was very that has really been determining for me in my as a linguist, which was it appears in his book in Lakoff's book Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things, which I highly recommend you read because it is very interesting. It has to do with how different languages conceptualize and categorize the world, and in this book it appears the sentence: language is a conceptual phenomenon. What does this mean? That this is a bit of this dichotomy between que va primero, el huevo o la gallina, right? What comes first? The concept or the term? What do you think? Well, this is a very interesting, it has to do with the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, where they give more depending on the hypothesis of what is first, we will give a language a specific power or not. For instance, well, I don't know if I'm explaining myself very well, but I'm going to give a very specific example. For instance, this whole nowadays debate about should we, in Spanish, where we only have grammatical gender based on masculine and feminine, and the neutral or the collective is also finishes in O, coming from Latin, should we use niñes to refer to niños and niñas? Should we create other mechanisms? And I always tell my friends, we should start by words, because it's completely useless to start saying niñes, and then when you are talking to your friends, say, oh, qué coñazo. Because we say cojonudo and we say coñazo. This is a debate already from the 90s, but nowadays it's even more relevant, because what it represents concepts, what shows how a language categorizes the world, is basically the words that are in that language, because they are directly related to the concepts. And we always have the same eternal debate. What comes first? A society that is basically machist, say, chauvinistic? Or is it language that contributes our way of thinking? So I always say there is also cases of violencia in countries where there is no grammatical gender. So maybe we should revise more our concepts. This is my humble opinion. I don't want to enter in this type of debates now. I know this is sensitive and everybody has their own opinion, very respectful, of course, but it's just a very an example of what conceptualization is. So we create concepts and then we express them. Or do we express something and then my humble opinion is that we first have languages used to represent what and reflect what we have in our reality. That's why we have the word shirimiri in the Basque Country to talk about the specific type of rain. This word doesn't exist probably, or maybe it has been imported, but this word is from the Basque Country. It's a Basque word to express a type of rain that in French they have a lot of words for bread. In Spain, until in the 90s, there was sobado, sobada hueca, de pueblo. That's it. There was no more. So, and now that we have more types of bread, we have introduced through new concepts, new words. So conceptualization is first, we have a reality, then we conceptualize it, and then by means of ontologies or by means of expression through words, we put them into language or into ontologies, which are artificial conceptual databases. That's why an ontology is also called a conceptual database, because it is based on concepts. What is important about conceptualization, it is that a very important feature is that it has to be shared among agents, which means that the same way as language is arbitrary and we decide to say, to call a streetlight semáforo, because we have decided that this is the word we are going to understand all of us, for conceptualization, for the idea of a concept, it is also, even if it is unconscious, a collective process. So we all contribute to the creating a specific social concept. And that's something that publicists, politicians, and opinion makers know very well. Okay? That this is a subconscious collective process. Another important theoretical concept that we need to know before continuing to the rest of the book is the difference between onomasiological and semasiological approach to language, which has to do also, is connected to this idea of what comes first, the form or the content, the word or the concept, the word or the reference. The semasiological approach, I have always to revise it, because for me it's also complicated. I know clearly the difference, but I always have to check, like, semasiological approach was the one that comes right for form and these things. So in the semasiological approach, we start with the name, so which means the form, and then we check from the words their interconnections and then the semantic relations of these words. So this is the basic starting point of terminologies. Whereas in onomasiological approach, the approach is first we start from the concept, from the meaning, and then we go to the form. That's why the onomasiological approach is the basis of ontologies. The use of a metalanguage is another important concept. I hope the previous distinction is clear. We will see more clearly when we see what an ontology is and what are terminologies. The use of a metalanguage is also an important theoretical concept. You have seen also metalanguages in other courses of this degree, obviously, because a metalanguage was used already by the first linguists, by the functional linguists, by cognitive linguists. All the linguists have tried to use their own metalanguage. This has been a bit like the laws in Spain, educational laws. No, mine is best. I'm going to change it. I have always discussed with some colleagues that it would have been much more useful to agree on a specific metalanguage and everybody use the same metalanguage, because precisely a metalanguage, what it involves, what it means is that it does is not connected to a language itself. So a metalanguage is like a language. Talk about language, And these symbols could be agreed, like in logics, for instance, they use specific types of symbols that can be or not related to a language. For instance, we have here an example of Corel. Corel is one meta language. Corel is a conceptual database that was developed by Ricardo Mayral. A very interesting one. This conceptual representation language, they proposed this type of language in order to improve the grammar of role and reference grammar. I like role and reference grammar very much personally. I really liked, let's say that it was easy for me to understand the language, the metalanguage of role and reference grammar, and it was much more difficult for me to understand the metalanguage used by generative grammar or even cognitive grammar. But this is a matter of taste. Ricardo Mayralos Usón, our rector, was also a follower and a friend of Van Veelen, who was the creator of the founder of role and reference grammar. And he attempted for many years to improve or to complete the metalanguage that appears in this type of grammar, which is part of functional grammars, such as functional grammar from Dick and Hengeveld, etc. So I recommend highly this link where they explain the foundations for the creation of two ontologies, one for lexical items and one for predicates. Predicates means words that express action or qualities, what we call in syntax adjectives and verbs versus nouns. Okay, so a metalanguage has basically categories and relations and procedures. And they have to represent with certain symbols these procedures and these categories and their relations. So we have many types of metalanguages, and metalanguages represent, as I said, concepts and relations, foundational concepts. So they have been used since the Greeks, since the Romans. Philosophy, the idea of the science of philosophy, philosophy itself, logics, is based on metalanguages. So this is something that is this cognitive process has been, this resource has been used by man since the beginning of knowledge. And it is especially important now to know what a metalanguage is, because it is also the basis of ontologies. It is important to know what a metalanguage is, because for the creation of ontology, we need a metalanguage. But we don't need a metalanguage for the creation of a terminology. We will see. We have also another important concept, which is language-dependent and language-independent knowledge representation. We can represent knowledge in two ways. Through language-dependent items. So, dictionaries, for instance, dictionaries are a way to represent knowledge, and dictionaries are based on language, our language. But we have language-independent knowledge representation, for instance, mathematical notation, parsers in ontologies, and metalanguages can be based both on language-dependent representation or on language-independent representation. Up to the creators of the metalanguage, whether they want the metalanguage to be closer to a language or not. Here we have also some philosophical debate, because when we create a metalanguage that is highly based on language-dependent knowledge representation, such as, for instance, role and reference grammar, what we use basically is English as the language, as the representation for all languages, and a metalanguage is supposed to be universal. This is something that happened also to Corel. Corel is a name is the aim of Corel was to create a universal meta language, but this universal meta language was not free from being also language dependent. Can we avoid language to create a meta language fully? This is very difficult. This is very difficult. And finally, we have also another important theoretical concept, which is which is the different approaches to meaning representation. The different approaches to meaning interpretation. First, cognitivism and ontologies. What has cognitivism done for ontologies? First of all, the cognitive theories, the most important contribution of cognitive linguistics to linguistics is the idea of categorization. This is something that stems even from Taylor in the 70s, that started talking about prototypical or non-prototypical or marked or unmarked concepts. Prototypicity, the idea of prototypicity based on Taylor, which means something we categorize as typical. We have in our mind the tendency as human language users to, for instance, identify a child with a healthy child. In our case, for instance, we would identify the child with a certain skin color, a certain type of hair, certain height, etc. So we have a prototypical child. We have many divergent type of children, especially nowadays where divergency is so much on fashion for everything. So we are now on an era of society where divergency is the trend. But before, until very recently, this was not the tendency. The tendency was to try to be as prototypical as possible, not to highlight above the mainstream. So, because apparently this has to do with something natural in the tendency of humans as social beings to be part of the group. So we create in our minds an idea, a prototypical plate of spaghetti. And we will probably all activate in our mind the same, almost the same type of image of what a spaghetti plate can be, right? So these are all these prototypical types that have been given. This idea of prototypicity has been given by cognitivism. Not only this idea of the types of concepts, like we can have functional concepts, relational concepts, individual, sortal, and the idea of category. So what type of category in order to structure frames of knowledge? So that's the contribution of cognitivism to the creation of ontologies, which is a very big contribution, obviously. Another important concept is the idea of predication is also a very important idea in functional linguistics, which was pioneered by Fillmore. And later on from Fillmore, we have role and reference grammar, functional grammar, etc. And Fillmore was also the source of this type of databases such as FrameNet or VerbNet. Predication is the idea that how would I explain? A verb, for instance, is a predicate. This idea of a verb being a predicate expressing an action, a specific type of action, comes from Fillmore from the 80s. So it is quite recent, as you can see. And on need this concept as a basic for the creation of the database. Okay, so these concepts that an ontology needs in order to start being complete is, as I said, prototypicity, prototypicality, categories, concepts, and predication. And finally, something that is important is also the philosophical perspective. So when we philosophy is a reflection on themselves. Here, the book introduces a quotation from Nirenberg and Ruskin, from 2004, where they say that the real distinction between ontologies and natural languages is that languages emerge and are used by people, while ontologies are constructed for computers. So people create ontologies, but ontologies, it is true, oh, se va la señal, dice una compañera. Pues es, ahora qué tal, es que esta a veces pasa, el año pasado también pasaba, esperemos que no se vaya del todo. Vale, si no lo podréis ver grabado, ¿de acuerdo? Well, this, okay, okay, so now it's fine. This is just a thought, an interesting thought, which is that when we build an ontology, we build an ontology for a computer to understand. So we don't build an ontology for humans to understand. We build an ontology for a computer to understand. That's why computer technicians are important nowadays in the building of ontologies. And in fact, in UNED, we have Salvador Ross from the Department of Computer Science, who has an interesting project. He designed a big ontology for poem reading, for instance. And he doesn't have knowledge about linguistics, but he knows what a computer needs to understand in order to give a specific concept or to store a specific concept and then to retrieve that concept. Okay, so that's the interesting part of ontologies, that ontologies need a language that can, the language for an ontology has to be understood by a computer. And that's why ontologies need the collaboration or the cooperation between linguists and computer technicians. And then another important concept is semantics in terminological applications. Okay. Now we go to terminology. Terminology is practically, very practical oriented. It does not focus on linguistic analysis. It doesn't care. Let's say that in terminology, we don't care whether a language comes from here, from there, how it is used. The only important thing is the use. They care about how a specific terminology is used. It is based on the meaning of the terminology, the objectives. For instance, in Ghent University, there is an important department where they work with terminological applications in the translation department, because they work for big companies such as Jan de Nul, etc. Jan de Nul is the big company that has constructed the different channels in the world, like Panama Channel, etc. So, for instance, a terminological database is important for translators. In a translator manual, for instance, they give in Jan de Nul a big database with all the specific vocabulary that is used in the company to talk about the construction of I don't know which channel, etc., etc. I don't have any idea about that, so I cannot give specific words in this case. But imagine we have a whole database of terms that are used by Jan de Nul users, and when a translator needs to translate this database or these instructions in several languages, we need first to create a database of terms. Also, what does a terminology is to take different terms that are used for the same concept and put them together. For instance, in we can give another a different example would be all the words that we use in Spanish to to pasear, for instance, dar un paseo, pasear, salir a andar, caminar, for instance. They have different small differences in sense, but let's say that they could all refer to the concept of going for a walk. Okay, So a terminological database will store all these terms, and terms don't refer to one word. They refer, can be an expression. So it's called chunks of words that refer to a specific concept. The concept in general would be salir a dar un paseo. And salir a dar un paseo would be expressed with one word or the whole, a whole phrase or a whole sentence, okay? So they are intelligent information retrieval. They can be multilingual or they can be monolingual. They are used for technical documents, to be used on a day-to-day basis. They can be used for science. So terminology in general is important for companies, for instance. And they are used in the appropriate uses of terminology are also important for production, for marketing, for sales. You could enter, for instance, as part of the staff of a big sales company. Imagine you are hired by, I don't know, by Amancio Ortega's Inditex in the sales department, and then they give you a series of terms that you need to use or you need to learn in order to deal with clients or in order to deal with colleagues, etc. This is also a terminology that you need to use appropriately, both with clients or with workers, with colleagues, etc. Okay, so this is a very practical oriented use of knowledge and of terminology and of language. I mean terminology. So terminology's main objective is standardization. This is the main concept that stems from terminology. First, when we standardize terminology, so we create standard terms, this helps too for the understanding of concepts, common understanding of documents, translatability. So for instance, we have one possible translation for different terms. Maintenance, which, so we have limited set of terms and translations. Retrievability, so it helps also to disambiguation. It helps consistency and consistency both in grammar and in selling. Okay, so that's why terminology is useful. When we build a term bank, we need three elements: a word processor, a database management system for instances, and a terminological management system. And we have different terminological management systems, such as multi-term, term star. And we also, if you want to see some examples of terminological databases, term banks, we have here some examples, the most famous ones, which are from the European Union, the most important. So, for the terminological work, we have some parts that coincide with the lexicographical work. For instance, the compilation of a corpus. The difference between lexicographical and terminological work at this step is that in the lexicographical work, depending on the type of dictionary we are compiling, if it is a general dictionary, it is all the text available. However, in terminology, we will compile a corpus of specific terms of a specific area of knowledge. Also, the structure of terms. We organize terms by concept. So first, from the all the terms that refer to a concept, we put them together, as I said before. We establish canonical forms, so the preferred terms. Canonical form is a very important concept in terminology. It is just as when we create a lexical entry. In this case, a canonical form, let's say that is the one that represents all the forms, all the variants that will be included in that concept. For instance, as I said, salir a pasear. We have caminar, salir a pasear, ir a dar un paseo. I don't know. This is a very silly example, but we would say caminar maybe, or salir a dar un paseo. We have to choose the canonical form. And then we will include the different variants, which let's say are less preferred, okay? Which doesn't mean they are not valid. And we will include the translation when it is a multilingual. Here we have, for instance, the concept in the presentation itself. For instance, with hablar, we have hablar, charlar, platicar, cotorrear, etc. So we will include all of them, and we will have the criterion, for instance, for the to choose the canonical form. Normally it is that it is the most commonly used, the most frequent term will be normally the canonical form, okay? And that was everything for this unit. Now it's time for asking doubts, for making comments. I hope you found it interesting. Springea RS, your name I don't see it, sorry. The section lexical descriptions theories is a bit challenging. Well, no, you don't need to learn things by heart unless they have to do with very specific parts of the, for instance, what are the different categories in a lexical entry in the future, or the types of derivation, or things like this. Different lexical description theories, you can try at least to remember the names of the different lexical theories. For this, I suggest you make schemas. Well, sometimes we ask for a metalanguage. No problem, Springia. And the other question is metalanguage something we will have to do in the exam? If so, you can you expand on the symbolism we have to use? Well, you have in the book, I'm gonna stop the recording first. I hope it works. No,